panelists, can you help us understand what the reasons for the large run on the Columbia River this past year were? Do I have any ideas about that?
I'm expecting something about work because they don't know anything about it. Well, it's really the way that we forecast those runs. They do a terrific job, that is, they're quite accurate, is by progressions of sibling returns in the cohort, meaning that age three returns in 1 year are a very good predictor of age four. The next year, they have a tremendous database. This is one of those things that it's an advantage of having dams in your system. We have dams because we count every fish over those dams. And that's one of the reasons why we're so accurate at predicting those. And then there are obvious signs of trend of wind survival, and I don't think they can forecast it very far into the future. They don't know that much about survival, so there's simply something good in the ocean where those fish come from. The majority of those fish that are carried are of one stock, one population, upriver wild populations, and even the hatchery counterparts in that system travel to the north, and so they probably benefit from good ocean conditions, environment, and their feeding migrations in the north.
All right. Thank you. Any other responses, panelists?
How can I explain the future?
During the summer of 2013, the southern residents were absent from the Sailor Sea much of the time and made a very late appearance. Some of the local naturalists were also observing that the Albion test fishery numbers were well below average and drew the conclusion that those numbers indicated low prey availability. What is the significance of those test fishery numbers? This question is part one of this three-part question. What have been the trends for Fraser River Chinook, and how is that affecting the presence of southern residents?
That low bit, the King Sky should have someone else say it.
I don't have that information about the Albion test fishery or Chinook salmon, the information that is collected every year from that station and is used for management of the sockeye runs and the salmon runs and back to Fraser, and the database exists for Chinook. Kyle Addicks, you can give me a sign if I'm reasonably correct with that. So there's some reason to think that there's a relationship between the test fishery and the catches and the money in that year. However, recall that there, in the analysis of the data, that there is, as was the conclusion of the science panel, that generally there is a correlation between survival and birth rates of southern resident killer whales with salmon populations in the aggregate. There's not a correlation with the Fraser population, although there may be counterintuitive or cross-challenging conclusions of this, of the studies that, we also know that Fraser River, you said, mentioned your comment, that they are, appears that Southern Resident Food Mill select that stock, so they don't know the mechanisms of that, or a higher proportion of their diet than is generally available in the same state.
Yeah, I don't know if you really answered the question in terms of how that influences the whales of the CFC or not. Last year was a really good year for some of the coastal zones, particularly in Columbia. And so, it's possible that there's a big advantage of those fish out of the coast. Geez, the Fraser itself, I don't really want to detail the ups and downs of the year of the Fraser, but the long-term trend for this Fraser stock is kind of similar to the things I showed in my talk. It's not too different from the general picture of shrimp as wide, which is kind of up and down. And some of the springland stocks that Canadians are concerned about,
great. Okay, now I have a couple of questions about other regions of the Chinook Recovery or Tana Department. This is a question that was directed to Lynn.
About
salmon recovery? No, about Oregon. No. You mentioned that yesterday, that you work closely with Elizabeth and the Beach Town Chinook Recovery folks. But what about salmon recovery efforts on the other Elizabeth regions that are important to the Columbia?
So I think in general, what we just reiterated and what we heard earlier today is that it's this coast-wide abundance of Chinook that's mostly correlated with the southern resident killer whales. So something I wanted to say earlier in my presentation, and we didn't, but Jeanette's talk in your wrap-up really made me realize that for the coordination between Oregon recovery and salmon recovery, we referenced the ongoing salmon recovery efforts, not just in Puget Sound, but coastwide in the killer whale recovery plan. And we really are relying on the infrastructure that exists, the efforts that are already underway for salmon recovery in Puget Sound and in other locations. And we're hopeful that we can coordinate and bring that killer whale base to salmon recovery to provide additional support, to provide something that people will connect with and relate to help support salmon recovery coastwide. So we aren't creating something new or inventing something new driven by a killer whale recovery plan. We're mostly just trying to support and plug in and tie in to the ongoing salmon recovery.
And following on to that, what, if any, value do you see in including the outer coast in killer whale critical habitat as a relevant issue?
So in January, NOAA received a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity asking us to revise our critical habitat for southern resident killer whales. Currently, we have over 2,500 square miles of inland water, including Puget Sound, designated as critical habitat. And one of the essential features that we identify for that habitat is sufficient prey, sufficient quantity and quality of the prey that the whales need. So in the petition from CP, they asked us also to look at coastal areas and to look at similar features, including prey. At the time we did the critical habitat following the listing back in 2005-2006, we had very little information on where the whales were and get more information.
The southern resident killer whale pods often come together in the vicinity of the San Juan Islands in the summer. It is also known that they often breed across pods. Is it possible that the lack of Chinook salmon in the Salish Sea in the summer months might change the patterns of social interaction and thereby impact the breeding success? And there's no good that there were no birds.
It is kind of an interesting question, though, because the distribution of the whales on the Arab coast is definitely somewhat pod specific in the Cape Gulf pods tend to be down further south and are observed and heard in salad tag and seen in California and all the coastal Oregon and so forth. J-pod just doesn't seem to do that. And since it's been in the center north. And so, yeah, it's kind of interesting. If they were birds, primarily on the coast, I guess see the logic behind the question. And also, as Daniel showed and thought, the pods have very different demographic trajectories, and that it can kind of lead the projections moving forward. The relative proportion of the population that's made up of J pod in particular is expected to grow a lot.
All right, great. How are various agencies monitoring on a regular basis the abundance of stocks of salmon that are available for southern resident killer whales and determining whether those stocks are sufficient for southern resident killer whales to buy?
Well, to break that question down a bit, speaking for someone in Washington, the state of Washington and the tribes work cooperatively in assessing the status of all of the populations of salmon in the Puget Sound, Columbia River, coastal area. And so we have good estimates of abundance. Changes on an annual basis and have a good understanding of the long-term trends. And we also have a lot of information about the distribution of those fish. We tag fish every year. And so each group year that is distributed in the migration path, we have information. It's another one of those downsides of the ways that we get information like dams. Way to get distribution information about salmon is by killing them and catching them and finding out where we killed them, caught them, and where they went. And so we know where they go. And so we have a very good idea. But the second part of the question about what is available for orca consumption, well, I'll just take a stab at the connection that is from the animals. Review and conclusions that if for example, in Puget Sound, we have to know a lot about the abundance of Puget Sound salmon. We don't have a good correlation between Puget Sound salmon and orca survival for grace. We also observe that they are not a major significant portion of salmon. They are not a significant portion of the diet. And so, it is, so the connection there is not made. We're keeping good abundance, but we do not know what the orcas really need for food, although Mike is one of the pieces of information is that they need a certain amount of kilocalories, and if they ate only chinook salmon, it would be about chinook salmon a day. They are pretty tricky, which fat little fragile guys they like to eat.
Actually, I just agree with that. One, they're earning a lot of international salmon in the summer based on what we've seen sample so far. They definitely do it in the winter. So when they're down the sound, and then deep sound proper, down around here, and Well, the whales do spend time in Puget Sound in the winter, not just on the outer coast. And the diet samples that we have from feeding events in the winter in Puget Sound they do eat in addition to chum, a lot of chum salmon, they also eat chinook salmon. And those are just based on where they are, you know, in South San Jose and South Seattle, are almost going to have to be the decisions.
Have to be work. I can tell when you see this or drops his voice at the end.
Thanks. All right, we have a couple of questions about extirpation. And so question one is, what are the main reasons for the historical extirpation of salmon on the coast? And if a population or an ESU of Chinook salmon has ever been extirpated, have we ever successfully reintroduced them? Have they ever come back? And is there an established method of restoring extirpated bugs?
I'll talk about that to begin with.
Okay.
So I talk about extirpations in Colombia, and in the interior, the bulk of those were caused by the construction of impassable dams, notably Grand Coulee in the Colombia, and followed by a whole series of Canadian dams above that, and Hell's Canyon Complex in Idaho, on the Snake River. And all of the runs that used to go above those points were extirpated at that time. So that's a major source in Colombia. There were some big runs for multiple species of chinook and coho and sockeye, steelhead that were lost at that time. So that was the main, that was in Colombia, that was sort of the main cause. There are discussions of reintroducing those runs. Columbia River Tribal Commission actually just had a conference in Portland on that a few weeks ago. And so they talked about that extensively. And it's a real challenge to do so, but there is some movement there. In terms of reintroductions, at least in Columbia, there are some examples of that. For example, in the Clearwater River, Chinook salmon were extirpated and have since been reintroduced and are now present. There's also some sort of funny introductions, again just drawing from Columbia. Coho salmon were historically not present in the Willamette River due to the presence of Willamette Falls, which is impassable to coho. When the falls were laddered, there were lots of attempts to introduce coho, and in fact, there's a lot of extra coho production in the land. At some point, that actually stuck, and now there's actually quite a large population of coho salmon in the land river that's been naturalized, and as a result of those introductions. So there's some examples.
Let me just add that there's some interest in Puget Sound in the Squamish watershed. The spring population in this Squamish watershed is extirpated and tried very interested in reintroducing a population of Squamish in that watershed. It's very interesting stages of research and discussion, but it's quite a few on the street. So thank you very much of interest to us and the other discussion.
Spring chinook in Puget Sound have been extirpated in a number of areas of the watersheds. And there's a lot of watersheds there's enough information to really know very well what the status of those were or the reasons for the extirpation. They're gone. And in the case of Squamish, there is an active program to reintroduce. And there are two major rootstocking programs in Puget Sound and the North End, Nooksack and Dungeness, where the original native stock has been all but extirpated. We don't even know if the current genetics match what was there historically, but there are remnant remainder populations, and there's a tremendous effort, very costly, brood stocking and restoring slowly with the right fish and with the complementary protections in fisheries to restore those runs. So there are another, several other examples of those. And interestingly, in the Skokomish, we are, the state and the Skokomish tribe are supporting and implementing the active program for spring chinook. We're also trying to establish a new run starting this year, going to be collecting late stock from the existing hatchery run, trying to establish a late fall run that we think was robust and alive and was extirpated. I think it's very important to know what was the cause of the extirpations, so we don't repeat it. We might assume that it was fishing, and we believe that fishing is far more reduced and controlled. And so, at least if that was one of the causes originally, there is some optimism from that angle to think that we could be successful.
And one last thing. So I have a very large note. What part of my notes is being at? So maybe one last example. On the Squally River, the fall chinook there was extirpated sometime in the 60s for a combination of reasons. We've been in the most recent 20 years working on reestablishing the fall chinook populations there. And there are a handful of examples where it's been done successfully, but not very many. And so we're proceeding with an experiment to see if we can use what was originally a Green River hatchery stock, localized to the Nisqually, and then over time have it become a naturalized Nisqually stock. It's complicated, and there are issues surrounding treaty rights, for example, I spoke about earlier. How do you balance the need to have a wild stock and still get provide enough harvest opportunity for the treaty fishery and the non-treaty fishery as well? So ours is very much an experiment. We'll see how it goes. We're just beginning to now separate, over the last couple of years, the hatchery stock from the natural spawning population. And we're studying it very carefully. The tribes in the state working on this project along with NOAA. And we'll see where it takes us and what it tells us. I think it's going to give us a lot of information for future kind of reintroductions in Puget Sound and maybe in Columbia as well.
Zach, did you
want to
say
something?
Yeah, so one of the Kings has a conservation hatchery program on the canal, and we're actually involved with this project. We're in some of the springs from the Tacoma tribe, Tacoma Power was engaged in that effort. But we've also been involved in trying to recover fall chinook population in the Hamahama River, and it's been really quite a challenge. We've been working with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, taking Green River chinook that have been not naturalized, but transferred and produced in a hatchery on the Skokomish River, and trying to naturalize them to a new system in the Hamahama. Just to provide people with a little bit of timing, how long this takes. I think we started this effort where we were releasing hatchery fish in the Hamahama River, and then collecting fish that came back, and trying to use fish that actually naturally spawned from that original placement, and then use those for brood stock in the hatchery to amplify the population. And under ESA, we had a target recovery number where we considered the population sustainable if we had 500 recurring adults. It's not a very big river. And we've been doing this since the late 90s. And it was one time in that entire period that we achieved that recovery target of 500 returning fish. Every other year, it's been 100, much smaller numbers. But the last two, and I was ready to pull the plug on the program because I felt like the more seeing what the Skokomish was doing with a different stock, maybe a fall stock wasn't the right stock to be using. Maybe we needed a late fall stock, or we couldn't get the population to adjust its behavior or plasticity of the behavior enough to become acclimatized to that river. But just the last couple of years, we've had really reasonably big returns, and I think we had 700 fish last year that were all spawned in the river. Weren't hatchery fish, they were fish of now naturalized origin. So it is possible, and I had an interesting question. We did talk earlier this week, or I'm sorry, last week, about the talk was focused on sustaining salmon in a rapidly urbanizing environment. One of the smart aleck questions I got was, about it. If a salmon is taken from another basin and put in a river that's a listed species and it establishes in that river, is it then listed and does it deserve reproductive protection? And I said that the examples I'm aware of, yes, but it's an interesting, philosophical question.
Right. Good. Conversation starter. Thanks. And this is addressed to the whole panel. Can someone address the impacts of harvesting forage fish, such as herring, on Chinook populations, and also the impacts of fish farms on Chinook populations?
Everybody's just making faces. What does that mean?
Or maybe it's so eager to respond. I don't really know very much about herring, but we do know that the status of herring in Puget Sound is not good. It's, I think, one of the slides of the different species that are doing well and on an upward trend versus down trend, they're not quantitatively, but herring populations are doing poorly. And it seems just logical that if a prey species like herring is doing poorly, that salmon or lion them are going to be doing poorly. Now, maybe that's just herring in Puget Sound, and one of the features of the biology of Chinook in Puget Sound, big basin like that, the same to see, is that they have different life histories. They adapt to the unique environment. They reside in Puget Sound. This was one of the reasons why in the late 70s, a tremendous success of hatcheries in Puget Sound was fish. There was great herring populations all through Puget Sound, all the way down through Olympia, and they're gone now. But the salmon stayed in Puget Sound year-round, and they don't any longer. They just aren't there, not anywhere near. So a very much smaller proportion of the population is staying resident within Puget Sound, and it could be that it's because herring aren't there, and they're having to leave. Maybe there are some cues in there that they receive from the environment that is not good here. We better travel north with the rest of the brood, and perhaps it's not so much a survival issue for those salmon stocks, but it's one that changes their distribution and maybe then ultimately even the availability for or consumption. It's just speculation. We don't have anywhere near the fish farms as in Canada. There's been a lot of debate and not a lot of scientific conclusion, I would say, about the impact of those farms on wild population. Famously, it's the sea lice on pink salmon and the effect on wild pink salmon. We just don't have the number of those farms. There is the more general question about the effect of hatchery fish on wild populations and recovery that Mike mentioned too, but we didn't get into, thank goodness. And it's a topic of its own, but those are very separate issues, I think. Fish farms, generally, I think they're talking about floating fish farms at sea, marine farms as opposed to hatcheries.
I was just curious, since Washington fish tend to go to the fish from the Chinook salmon, and most of them stay south, so they're migrating out, but it seems like there would be a definite potential concern for Washington Sandy in the expansion of salmon agriculture in the sea. Is there any federal communications along those lines or anything that's gone on?
I don't know the answer to that from a policy point of view. From a science point of view, there is, you know, there is some science indications that some of the recent disease scares that came out in British Columbia. There was exchange of samples and also analysis of data. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
That
next up,
Dan,
do you know?
Yeah, the disease thing is really common, particularly in D.C., and I think if you ask scientists in the know on this one, they'd say the jury is out on this one. There's a lot of hype over salmon farm, particularly viral diseases that affect wild fish, but and people who really know that work would say that, you know, there's no clear evidence that salmon farms affect wild fish, except for the pink salmon sea lice.
There was a question also about the fishery. Washington State has like a very small herring fishery for just for the bait, for fish and line hooking. But I don't actually know the quantity amount that they're taking, but the fishery has been significantly curtailed.
That
was part
on,
of on herring.
On herring.
But there still is a fishery for fish.
Okay. A fishery for fish.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a question for Mike. If you would be so good as to put together for us the historical runs versus the present runs for the United States relative to Canada.
What'd you say? Historical runs for Canada.
I don't know if I could pull that information together from actually a talk with Jim Myers, a colleague at the Center, put together on a lot of other sources of information. That he gave back to the panel process that Daniel's involved in. And Canadian historical information seems a little, it's a little snottier. But at least from what Jim put together, the degree of reduction seems more kind of typical of Puget Sound. Less dramatic than the scene in the Columbia or the Sacramento. The estimates, the historical estimates based on counter impact for the Fraser, which I confess I'm not really familiar with the details of. If you just look at the numbers, the Fraser is not radically lower in terms of its Chinook abundance than the historical estimates. It's kind of more like the same on the reporters.
I'm not at all, but I just wanted to let folks know that Daniel did an excellent job boiling down a tremendous amount of information that was presented to the science panel throughout three different workshops. And all of those presentations and all of that information is available on our website. If anyone is interested in really digging back down into specific presentations on different topics, the agendas are there, the presentations are there, and they're available. Great. And the report is also available in its full form, lots of good data.
Yeah, so I was just going to comment on the salmon abundance thing. I mean, it's pretty common that we'd like to assume that there was a single baseline to which we can compare. But if you look at, I'm most familiar with Alaska salmon fisheries, but if you look at salmon populations up there, the thing to realize is the populations are never at a static equilibrium. They're always bouncing around. There's year-to-year variation, and now we know there's really strong decade-to-decade variation, and there's century-to-century scale variation that we can see in paleo studies. So, yeah, you can always pick a decade that's below expectation, and there's always a decade or two that are above expectation. With respect to Chinook salmon, I think it's worth recognizing that in the last 3 or 4 years, Alaska Chinook stocks have essentially no commercial fisheries on them the last few years, particularly for the Yukon and the Kuskokwim rivers, which are two huge rivers, the stocks continue to decline in the last couple of years, and it's coincident with the shift in the Pacific cable oscillation and the fact that we're seeing a whole bunch of fish showing up in the Columbia and the Klamath River. So, you know, these, even some of these time series are pretty long from a scientific standpoint relative to this time scale of sedimentary decades and centuries. It's really hard to figure out what a true baseline is. You should expect that the stocks are going to wax and wane, and all the species that depend on them are probably also going to be chasing them around as well. So there's no harmonious equilibrium in the past. The equilibrium is always bouncing around.
Thanks. And while you have the mic, there's another question that was directed to you, although Pat might be a little clear with this one, I think. What is the effect of sport fishing on Chinook returns to the Sound Rivers, especially this region?
I did a presentation on recreational fisheries over at the University of Washington this morning, and I just happened to look at, present the results of the fisheries that are have just been adopted for a year, as David was talking about, how with the outcomes of regulations and all of the fisheries from Alaska to California, inside out, freshwater, marine. And the interesting thing that I found was how small the recreational fishery in Puget Sound is in terms of the total population of Puget Sound. Examples that I looked at were in Skagit and Lake Washington, which have populations, and they are only about 3 or 4 percentage points of the, so 3 or 4% of the total population for that stock. Now we make these estimates every year based on all that tag information that we have that comes together with adjusting for the abundance that's going to happen for this year and expected size of the fisheries, and we certainly have in the last couple of decades much reduced fisheries in Puget Sound that are focused on returning Puget Sound Chinook tribal and state fisheries. We don't have any more commercial fisheries with non-Indians on Chinook or Coast, and the remaining recreation fisheries are quite small. So speculating about Fraser, their fisheries are larger. They have fewer restrictions. They're open pretty much year-round. They have a different set of allocations that they use, but I don't think that their recreational fisheries in the Salish Sea region are very much larger in proportion of that population. And I would guess that it's less than 10% anyway, the harvest rate in proportion of the population is affected by the sport fisheries.
And then following on that theme, can you talk about what the department does in terms of programs to encourage fishermen, fishing people, fishers, to stay in compliance with the law, sort of an eyes on the water?
Oh, sure. We have eyes on the water, and there are guys with guns, too. I think, in the state of Washington, the most capable professional enforcement program for fisheries on the coast, and maybe the nation. Pretty proud of that. But it's important to note that we work with no fisheries enforcement and with tribal enforcement. And it's not without its controversy, but we align ourselves together. A lot of our enforcement officers are educated together, and so there's a lot of cooperation. There are a lot of officers out there. Some of them they're in plain clothes, and you'll be found. Don't go out there without your license. Follow the rules. They have a pretty good track record of catching bad guys. And they also, just to mention about killing them, there are restrictions on people's behavior on the water in association with authorities, and they're required to stay 200 yards away, not drive boats into the path of the migrating orcas, and so bad behavior on that part, on the part of maybe innocent voters, not necessarily some of the fishing, can result in fines or confiscation of the vessel. So there's a lot of that. We do encourage the sort of eyes on the water, reporting, poaching for fish, fishing violations, or simply observe something going on there that doesn't seem to be consistent. It's a big deal.
Pat, I recall in some of the Norfolk docking process in the prior, we would get reports from enforcement about their water activities. And it's just awesome to see what the fact all, at least on the marine water, they're seeing better than 92% compliance with the regulations. It's been a couple of years ago. The track record is pretty good.
All right. I don't have time. We spend about 10 more minutes on these kinds of specific questions and then maybe see if we can do some next steps. Even though there are broad trends in declining survival, there are exceptions, such as late-timing graduation of two nurses. Are you looking at these exceptions, and are you learning anything about them?
Our colleagues in British Columbia are trying to work on populations that have shown both a and populations as that one that have not shown such a decrease. And again, the idea is to follow the fish around and see what their status is as they develop in Puget Sound or in the Strait of Georgia, look at the conditions around them, the feeding conditions, other factors, and try to determine from that what is the health of the juvenile fish and can be determined from the surrounding environment that might be causing them to be in good, superior health suffering significant mortality is demonstrated by loss of numbers. It gets harder and harder to track the fish around as they disperse around the school. But now that we have genetic analysis, we can fairly quickly identify which are raising the fish. If I could
add to that, there's undoubtedly going to be anomalies over time that maybe confuse the situation, but I think all the indications that we see is that there is definitely a marine survival issue in Puget Sound that needs to be addressed. And a tremendous example that I'm familiar with is the Nisqually Sealant that I spoke about a little bit earlier. Population's gone from thousands to now less than several hundred. And we did some acoustic tagging and tracking fish through Puget Sound, and we were seeing upwards of 92 or 93% mortality between the mouth of the Nisqually River and Port Angeles. Fish are dying at an alarming rate out there. And when you look at the Nisqually watershed, I think you can successfully make the argument that the freshwater habitat is in better condition than it's been in over 100 years. With the estuary restoration, with all the habitat protection we've done, the main stem of the Nisqually is protected to the extent of 77% of it is in permanent stewardship. It's getting better and more mature, and the habitat complexity is there, and yet we're still not seeing the returning seals that benefit from that. So it's clearly in our mind something that's going on in marine waters. And what our tagging study showed is that their residency time in Puget Sound for these steelhead is 14 days. So in 14 days, we're seeing that kind of mortality. It's really telling us there's a problem that we need to address.
Amen. My question for you.
Yeah.
Can you please talk about how recovery efforts can be directed to address the threat of high level contamination and how salmon health talk about the salmon health impacts on recovery and return goals.
I think I got the first part. I'm not sure about the second part.
Yeah.
So I'll start with the
garbage. Yes.
So today we're focused on prey as a primary issue for this discussion. But our recovery program addresses all the main threats, including the regulations for vessels that Pat just mentioned, and contaminants as well. Contaminants has been really challenging, but in the recent years, we've had some good success working with EPA. It came out of some actions identified in the biological opinion on the joint base Lewis and Port. discharge permit. And so we identified some focus work that we could do to improve monitoring and information, particularly surrounding PBDEs, flame retardants. Those are contaminants that aren't highly regulated or monitored in our system. So we also worked with the Puget Sound Partnership and the Toxics Work Group and the Marine Mammal Work Group to bring people together and identify what are some of the steps we can take to move forward, to look at monitoring, to look at what the levels we're seeing in the Puget Sound, where they're coming from, and then how that goes up the food chain to the killer whales. So definitely a part of our sort of three-pronged approach with the recovery program to address all of the threats, not knowing sort of which could be the most important right now for reproduction and survival. And I think just looking at health in general, looking at the data we have on contaminant levels of different types in the whales, we don't have specific thresholds right now that tell us when a level of contaminants has a certain health consequence for the whales, but we can look at other species. We do know what those thresholds are for species like harbor seals, so that's informative to us as well. So definitely an area of ongoing effort to address contaminants.
Yeah. And this is an issue that's near and dear to the tribes, and you've probably heard that we've been working with EPA and Ecology over the last, well, aggressively 2 years, but it's really been about 15 years, in efforts to address the fish consumption rate issue in the state of Washington. We currently have the lowest standard in the country. It's a federal standard at 6.5 grams per day. And would like to give you a presentation. You mentioned the killer whale populations eating like 1,000 shrimp a day. They are way in excess of EPA standards. They are in trouble. So there's definitely a connection between the work that we're trying to do to make sure that we return salmon, that we're able to harvest salmon, and that we can eat them and not die, and that other things can eat them and not die as well. So this fish consumption rate issue goes really directly to this restoration and recovery of salmon and also the orca population as well. So you'll be hearing a lot more about that. Ecology is due to release a draft rule sometime in June, and I think it'll be great if you all can consider that and weigh in a positive way to protect people and protect whales and protect salmon.
I think that, go ahead.
I was going to comment on this because I always find it interesting that the contaminants that draw the most attention are the ones that bioaccumulate, but yet, the contaminants that are emerging, particularly in freshwater systems in big urban areas, are often water soluble ones that are hormones and pharmaceuticals that are not treated or sewage treatment plants that are dumped right into the Puget Sound. And there's very little work on those things, and they don't bioaccumulate. So for whatever reason, they don't seem to draw the attention of the people doing the endocrinology. But anyhow, there's reasons to be concerned about those things as well.
And I think the second part of the question, if Jordan and Keith is still here, you can let me know. It's talking about the effects of salmon health on recovery and concerns for work. So thank you.
Well, and one of the challenges is that there are different concerns about contaminants for salmon. Copper and metals is often something that we look at that impacts the capabilities of salmon, whereas it is the persistent accumulation of those other contaminants that we're concerned about for whales. So definitely some challenges in aligning those two recovery efforts because they're not always the same. Both important.
And then sticking with health issues, how good is the science on southern resident killer whale nutrition, health, and relative condition? So and there's two sub-questions. Is it clear that they are lacking prey? I think Daniel had a picture of the thin whale. And then secondly, if so, has anyone considered rearing hatchery chinooks and imprinting or releasing smolts for adult returns just for orcas?
I think there actually was a proposal at some point to have a whale hatchery. I think the existing hatchery production is probably pretty important for the whales. I mean, whether an additional fall shrimp catchery, that's a pretty minor change to the overall budget to build whales. You know, just on pure mock brainstorming speculation kind of thing, you know, you might argue that maybe as a temporary measure, you know, some additional production extension of this might be a great benefit to the whales potentially.
So on the spring chinook issue, and I'm really sorry I missed the earlier part of this discussion because I'm very, very interested in this. I was in a Sea Grant, we were attoning or whatever, we were doing a report on Sea Grant funded research for federal Sea Grant program reviewers. And Sam Blosser gave his presentation on evaluating stress levels in orcas. And I was struck by the data that indicated a weak correlation between interactions with boats, but a strong correlation, a seasonal correlation in terms of the condition that the whales were when they entered Puget Sound in the spring. And I've been thinking about this. I also, a separate piece of data, but related, as part of the Marine Survival Project, Ken Gorhite, who's a geneticist at the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, presented a figure at that workshop in February 2012, where he showed that the change in the proportion of salmon, naturally spawning salmon in Puget Sound rivers has gone from being 50% spring or summer chinook, 50% Green River origin fall chinook, to a much, much higher proportion. Like he said, something like 90% Green River origin fish are now returning to spawn in our rivers, and about 10% of the early returning fish. This is a genetic analysis, but I think that it is consistent with the orcas being stressed for food resources early in the season. And I don't know how valid that is, but it certainly occurred to me. And the notion of actually, if we want to adjust hatchery production to be not only more friendly for chinook that return early in the summer, but also for just providing natural variability to our mantis fish population so they would leave the hatcheries in the rivers at different times and experience different conditions in the environment. And sometimes, as Daniel says, they succeed. If they were a spring or a release, it whenever a spring fish goes out, and the size being a different food resource than a fall population. So this, I think this is worth exploring in terms of the relationship between food resources for orcas and also in relationship to us thinking about a sustainable management of hatchery populations in this urban environment where returning to highly productive natural rivers in every case of Puget Sound is not likely. So we want to foster natural production in those rivers where it is sustainable. We want to foster natural production in urbanized rivers to the extent possible, but we are going to be supplementing fisheries and perhaps supplementing food for orcas using hatcheries for a very, very long time in the system, and we need to mature that system. Now, it's very difficult to rear a spring chinook in a hatchery program. It's much more expensive. It's challenging to keep an adult fish alive and happy after it returns to a lost spawn. The second issue that might be related to this that I think is very interesting, and I understand you talked about this, is the size of chinook. And I remember when I was at the opening of the ceremony around the removal of the Elba dams, and there was a conversation at our table around the size of fish and how the size of fish had changed in that basin. And the conversation went to the place where there were still very, very large chinook returning to that river basin long after the dams were built. And Randy Johnson, who's now with the Jamestown Spinal Tribe, I believe, but he's doing WDFWC, said that it's because of ocean fishing. Now, I don't know if that's the case, but if you think statistically, if a fish, a long lived large fish is in the ocean for a number of years, it's going to have a much higher probability of being captured in an ocean fishery than a fish that enters the ocean and only lives in the ocean for a couple of years. So the chance of fishing predation, if you will, if there's an annual chance of being harvested through an ocean troll fishery,
goes up for a longer-lived fish. And it would be interesting to evaluate the impacts of that in terms of the timing of the increase or the increase of intensity of ocean fisheries versus the average size of fish returning to the basin. Some of the spring populations tended to be very large, not always, so we can't, that isn't necessarily a relationship between spring populations, but there may be other factors that are affecting the size, and if you think about it from the whale's perspective, energetics of catching a bigger fish are favorable versus a smaller one if they swim roughly similar speed. So it's interesting things to think about, and I think there's a lot of room for us to think about proactive salmon management that can both benefit killer whales potentially and also benefit our management and sustainability of our salmon populations as we think about how to manage them in a future population with 6 million people on our half of the disabled sea.
Daniel,
do
you want to add to that?
Yeah, just commenting on the idea that fishing can reduce the size of the Chinook, I mean, clearly that is very plausible and very likely. But one thing to keep in mind is that the intensity of the commercial fisheries has been decreased substantially the last 20 years. And during that time period, the size of Chinook returning into rivers has continued to decline coast-wide all the way from the Yukon River down to the California River. So something else is going on. Maybe fishing has something to do with it, but it's pretty clear that something else is going on out there because, again, Chinook aren't fished the same way everywhere and certainly not the same intensity. And most commercial fisheries are modest at best in the last 20 years.
There's a lot of work on that, on this size thing. I don't know if there's any emerge. It's also part of it's not the size, but also age. And where the hatchery issue is that whole thing again, that particularly for Chinook, there is a bit of a tendency for hatchery fish to return again.
Okay, so what I'd like to do, I have a few, sorry,
was there more? I was just perhaps the proportion of large, the older ones, is being divided by purpose. So that is good, it's not that reasonable.
Yeah.
The other thing is,
Daniel,
the other thing that's happening in Alaska systems, which again, no explanation for the sex ratio is changing a lot. It's not just the big fish that are showing up, the big females are showing up. The escape is now almost 2-1 male to females, which is not a good thing.
Right,
a lot of really big females come in the spring fest or something that big happen. Anyway, this is a good point about the hatcheries. Maybe there are things we can do in our hatcheries to manage differently that can foster and not just changing from fall to spring, but changing the way we release fish. We do things very, very differently in the conservation hatchery that versus the small hatchery we run to support harvest in the San Juan. And those fish, we tend to rear them much more closely to how wild fish are reared. A lot of food, they spend 2 years rearing rather than 1 year getting very fat and going out. So maybe there are things we can do with feeders in order to not foster a return. It can be more expensive.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, harvest is the issue. It's not me because I've been trying to get big fish.
All right. Anything else? Sorry.
I was just going to, you have to touch back on the beginning part of that question about health status and just say that that's really an important area of work moving forward, of bringing together all the information that we do have about potential nutritional stress, disease issues, contaminant levels, and bringing that all together to get a better sense of what is the health status of individual whales, how does that change through different seasons, and it's definitely an area of ongoing. And I'll just put in a quick plug for our marine mammal stranding network. That is a really important source of data for us when we do have animals that die in our washed up on our beaches. It gives us a great opportunity to do a full exam, a full investigation to try and learn as much as we can about all those different health factors. So that's a plug for
shameless plug.
Yeah. Great screening number. Thank you.
Great. Okay. questions here that are science and data related. I'd like to hold those. If you have more time at the end, that'd be great. I'd like to switch over to a conversation about next steps and how people can get involved. Yeah? Okay. We have some questions here about how to be helpful, how to be involved, how to make things happen. So once elementary students have learned about the plight of Santa, do you have suggestions of actions they can take individually to make a difference where they are? Kids are so great because they are so curious and just willing to listen. And I've heard some folks recently talking about how they can really help inspire their parents and their community by the work they do. I think that at the level of kids, one of the things that's been really interesting to me to watch is the evolution of environmental education in our country. And I think that there are a lot of folks that are very attuned to the issues of clean water and garbage and recycling, those kinds of things. And I actually took my son out to an event that was welcoming the salmon back out on Port Salmon Street in Brunswick of the Cal River. And there was a woman there from the Muckleshoot tribe who was telling old sort of a little myth story about the raven. And it was an educational story for the kids at the same time. And she would ask the kids at the end, what can you do to take care of the stream? And most of the kids said things like, pick up garbage, don't throw garbage in the stream, those kinds of things. And my son, because he has no choice, I drag him around all the time and teach him about what I know about salmon restoration, and he does tree plantings along local streams and helps plant rain gardens. I sort of prodded him and said, Michael, what is something that you have done to help the salmon? And he said, plant trees on the stream. And the look on this woman's face, she looked at him and she said, I have been doing this for so long, and you're the first kid that's ever said that.
Wow.
And she said, I'm gonna go get something. And she went back and she brought out this drumstick and she said, this is my family drumstick, and I want you to have it. And it was really touching, and at the same time I thought, wow, we've done such a great job with all the folks that got inspired about clean water and the Clean Water Act. Teaching our kids about the importance of keeping our water clean, but we have not instilled yet that community understanding of the importance of the physical habitat and trees and native plants and that kind of thing. So I think that's something that I'd really like to see in the evolution of environmental education, that people understand that it's both. It's clean water, but it's also that physical habitat. Having places where the fish can rest and hide and feed. The water can be beautiful and clean, and if there's no place for them to rest or hide or feed, they're still not gonna make it. So I think things like planting trees along the streams. And shorelines, yes, exactly. And then I think the other thing too, like, so those individual actions, I think the most important things is planting native trees and plants along shorelines, both marine and streams. But the other thing too is in those more urban areas is restoring the hydrology of our system. And so I'm also very interested in the work that's going on right now to retrofit areas where there's old stormwater systems, especially in areas where it can make a difference for stream flow and water quality, some critical areas for habitat, where you actually go into areas and install rain gardens and have that water start infiltrating back into the ground as it used to do when there was a forest there. That was a big thing that we did. I didn't mention earlier, but I used to work for David at the Squally. And one of the things that I was most excited about that we were working on there, the Squally tribe has continued since I left, is working with the town of Eatonville to help them revamp their stormwater plan so that they are
looking at how they can retrofit their stormwater and infiltrate it into the ground to restore the flow and the clean water in the two sailing streams that run on either side of town. And so the combination of planting trees along the streams and installing rain gardens, and just more natural sorts of yard care kinds of things where instead of grass everywhere, we have native plants. Even if it's not on the shoreline, it acts more like a natural filter that restores that ecology. So when it gets to that level of individual actions, I think that's one of the most important things we can teach the kids.
Thanks, Jenna. I saw David and then Ed and Rich.
Popular question. So one of the things today was referring to is the evolution and changing in environmental education. And I think it's been critical to see these changes over a career. We've been one of the hats that you wear is the chair of the Small River Council. It's the oldest watershed council west of the Mississippi. And we started the Small River Education Program in 1990. We've now got the second generation of kids coming through that program. And the fundamental key to that program that our first chair of the Small River Council said, Hal Wolf, in 1987, was we need to get kids' feet wet. And that's where it makes a difference. When they get their hands wet and their feet wet, it leaves an impression. One of the great things we do that gets their entire body wet is we do frozen salmon carcass tossing in the upper watershed. And there is absolutely nothing more enjoyable than watching fifth graders or third graders hauling frozen salmon in their arms like it's the most precious thing they've ever had, kissing them before they throw them into the stream. Fortunately, we don't get the phone call from the parents the next day about, what did you do to my kids? We cannot get the smell out. Evolving our programs to be out of the classroom and in the field and getting kids to be wet again and again and again, because we're doing K through 12, and what we found is that from K through 5, it takes repeated experiences to really have the same thing. So it takes patience and commitment to make it happen. Now, one of the challenges we have in environmental education is that some of our school districts are becoming much more conservative in their willingness to take risks. And insurance for getting kids out on the streams and having them get close to the water frightens some school districts. We've had school districts involved with our program now for over 20 years, and a couple of them have backed away because of insurance issues and the risk and liability of having a kid fall in. We've never had one fall in. Never happen. We take precautions to make sure it doesn't happen, but we're moving towards this much more careful society, and it's disconnecting from the natural world because it's afraid of it. We've got to break through that barrier and get past that. And then once we've got past that, there are tons of opportunities out there to get folks involved and volunteers involved, adults and kids alike. If you were to check with each of the lead entity coordinators in your local watersheds, and farmer raised up in hand, those people have opportunities out there. There's tons of things that can be done on almost any given weekend, from planting vegetation to pulling knotweed to whatever it might be, lots of opportunities. Jeanette, I think, has a finger on that pulse. And if you were to get a hold of Jeanette in her office, she can get you in touch with your local community people to get you out of the water.
Yeah.
As a scientist, I agree with you guys, but as a citizen, I don't. The best thing we can do when we have kids to do is to write our political representative and tell them it's important. I mean, I agree climbing trees is important, but letting policymakers who hold the purse string to know that this is important to the citizens is going to have a much bigger bang for your buck in the long run than signing all the trees in the world. As we saw what some of these budgets were for what salmon restoration is going to cost, those are big numbers. The money's going to come from somewhere.
Rich, Lindsay.
So this is great. Good meeting. My feeling is that the environmental education we've been doing in the elementary schools over the last 30 years has paid off. And they're finally getting mature. So the best thing to tell your elementary students is to go out and vote as soon as they can. And I have a 29-year-old daughter who went through thorough environmental education. And she didn't learn the environmental science, she learned the political science. But nevertheless, that it really showed me how much she can carry on. Most kids are getting mature now, and they are starting to vote. You might see this in the next election. That being said, there's a couple of things. One thing is that I think we should start forcing our school districts to have civics classes in addition to the outdoor environmental stuff, because the two are hand in hand. And then finally, I see a really good entrepreneurial opportunity out there for busing kids out to field sites. We've been referring to the fact that school districts are getting scared of the liability. I'm even running into that out on the outer coast. We have kids who want to do salmon restoration projects all over the place, and the school districts are concerned. We can't find a bus that can actually take the students out. If you only got five or six students who are going out to do a project, they can't justify a school bus for that. We're trying to figure out how to use the University of Washington van to take them out, but we still have a liability issue that the university won't deal with. So it seems to me that there is a real need to get kids out to do field projects legally and safely. Somebody could actually make a good one.
Do you
want to wrap this up on this one? I want to push back on the notion a little bit that the most important thing they can do is vote, which is undoubtedly true, but until they're 18, it really isn't an option. And the intent of the environmental education program is to create more informed voters, in essence, over time. So giving them opportunities to get in the field, get their feet wet, and really have those messages sink in will have more informed people making better decisions over time. Ultimately, the best regulations in the world are ones that are voluntarily complied with. And you do that because you understand the intent and the reasoning behind it. And that's where the focus of environmental education is.
Okay. So building on the notion of political science a little bit here, I have two shoreline armoring related questions. One is, how do we build support to stop bulkheads? Great question. And is the Puget Sound Partnership going to mobilize money for education, outreach, and financial incentives for homeowners to do vegetation projects in South Shorelines and remove or avoid
shoreline harm? Yeah. I'll address the first question first. And this goes back to many conversations Jeanette and I have had over the years. I mentioned in my presentation that in the Squally, we currently have 77% of the main stem is in permanent stewardship. That didn't come through regulations. That didn't come through necessarily buying all the land that we're buying. It really came through relationships and working with folks to get them to understand what the right thing to do was. And we invested a tremendous amount in educating our watershed citizens about their role and place in the watershed. And I think because of that, we have created this unique gem in the nation in the Squally watershed. And what Jeanette and I have noticed is that we have not invested that same kind of energy and effort on our marine shorelines. Undoubtedly, our regulations need to be stiffer. We need to make sure that we don't lose habitat. But we haven't created that mechanism yet to raise the level of understanding of our shoreline owners to get why they should voluntarily comply, and in fact, get why they shouldn't be looking for regulatory relief and permits in the first place. And it seems to me that that's a step we need to take. We need to take it fairly soon. Because ultimately, they're the voters that are going to make decisions about how these things go forward. Now, we've had associated with our Salmon Recovery Council, a number of tremendous elected officials who've gone out on limbs, way out on limbs, to do the right thing. One of them is with us here, Dr. Don, and others who, as a result of getting out on the limb and doing the right thing to protect this habitat and ecosystem for future generations, they lose elections. Sorry, but that was a little painful, Don. But that's how we can also support getting the right thing done, is recognizing where our elected leaders are being bold out there. And we've had some bold ones, and we don't value that enough. We let them go away. And we tend to focus on maybe other issues that maybe are capturing the importance of the day, or maybe not the importance of a generation. And we don't support them when they have to make really tough decisions. The folks that show up at public hearings are the handful of folks that are upset about a proposed regulatory change around shoreline, for example. Those around the world who think it's a great idea, they're off at soccer games or whatever they're doing, but they're not there voicing their support for it, and it leaves our electeds hanging out there, and it's tough for them, and we lose really good leadership along the way, so we need to keep those folks I'm looking for you twice next time, John.
I have to move to Bellevue. Jeanette and then Elizabeth?
That was a long question about what we,
yes,
partnership was,
what was going to do. Are you going to mobilize money for outreach and financial incentives to homeowners to do vegetation projects and or soft shoreline projects and or avoid or remove armoring?
How much detail to go into.
Yeah.
So the partnership is as a convening organization, we actually don't, we certainly can work with our partners to ask for that kind of funding, but the kinds of activities that are being talked about in that description are not things that are done through the Center Recovery Funding Board process, which is what we have more a direct role in helping to facilitate connecting the implementers with the partners. So one of the things that we are working on with our SAMR recovery partners, the lead entities, is how do we match up funding sources that combine those kinds of things, which are critical, to the folks on the ground that are trying to do those projects and into the watersheds. And so we are having conversations with EPA, not specifically about that particular aspect, but how do we better match up funds to the projects that are the highest priority in the local watersheds. And that funding is more flexible than the SAM recovery funds that are focused on capital projects. So I think that's one avenue, but there's more conversations to have. It's not that the people that work with me alone will decide if we think this is the most important thing, so we're going to send a bunch of money that way. Elizabeth?
I think there are a whole bunch of things that are underlying this issue. One of them is an interest in property rights and the ability, if you own a piece of shoreline, to be able to view the shoreline, you're less to be able to do what you want with it. And in our state, we have an exemption for single-family residential homes. It essentially says it's okay to protect your property. I am not a shoreline property owner, and if I were, I would probably fight tooth and nail to hold on to that. However, over time, that's become a really, really big problem in Puget Sound, as you all wrote, as the question knows. In response to the treaty rights of this white paper, I'm working this issue pretty heavily with the federal caucus, with EPA, and Corps of Engineers. And we have a really interesting situation with the Corps where we'll get to those recommendations in a minute. But with the Corps, they have a nationwide general permit for the east side of Puget Sound, a certain number of the watershed resource inventory areas where shoreline permitting of any kind is not allowed. On the west side, it's that regional general permit condition is not accessible. It's really interesting if you look at where the developed areas, where is it already armored? It's already armored on the east side, so the general permit prohibition doesn't do anything substantively and materially. On the west side, where it's not so fully developed, we've been saying, we work with you to figure out what the right narrative will be and help you with political support to actually have a similar regional general permit condition that would apply to the areas that are not yet already built out. What good does it do when we are already built out? We are having a really difficult time in that conversation in the panel. Further, we only see a tiny slice of the projects that go in being known through our Section 7 analysis under Species Act and or the Corps through Clean Water Act permitting. So until we can provide to landowners some of the support that was just discussed by Jeanette and provide them the education and I guess incentives to do whatever bulkhead installation and or repair in a way that is efficient and we do have a lot of that information available. I think we are going to be able to really crack this nut. I think there's a lot of interest in closing that loophole in state regulations and local regulations that would essentially make a prohibition on those single-family residential bulkheads as well. That is a very long-standing conversation I have when I was at the state and I had at the federal level. I don't think that is going to be a fruitful conversation in the near term. The more productive conversation would be if you are going to build a bulkhead and for repair, how can you do it in a way that is fish-friendly? Organization or and lots of others, including them, have a good deal of information about that. I'm sure my name would be interested in knowing. In fact, there's a new system on the Department of Fish and Wildlife that's really, really explains exactly how one could do that kind of conservation in a way that's compatible with salmon recoveries and sustainability. So I think keep working the politicals, as a number of people have already said, continue to put pressure on us, ESA folks at home, to work with our federal colleagues to try and do something meaningful on the west side of Puget Sound while we still can. That nationwide permit, for those of you that track this kind of thing, is going to come up for renewal in 2017. I would love for us to have something on the table that was material substantive by 2015, so that when we get into that local process, we have something to be able to do. And that's what I want.
Great.
David?
So the two subjects we've just talked about are very much related to the notion of regulatory structures and incentive packages. And there's a, maybe it's very simple, but there's a relationship between the two. That the notion that we want to have functioning habitat is regulation plus incentive packages give you functioning habitat. And as you move these around, you end up hopefully you're still achieving your goal. So if you invest heavily in incentive packages, incentive programs, you don't need to have draconian widespread regulation. But the extent that you don't invest in incentive packages, you have to have some other mechanism to assure you're getting the outcome. Where we're finding ourselves now is that we're funding about 20% of the need, so we're not really getting the incentive packages out there that's necessary, and we're not following up with regulations to protect the habitat. So the equation isn't working, and we're losing ground, and we've got to balance that. And it's tough choices. Do we have stronger, stiffer regulations, or do we take our limited resources that could be used for education or something else and invest it in incentive packages for property owners? It's a challenge, but we need to deal with that.
Last thoughts on that question? No? Okay, then I have one for you guys. So this is actually pretty exciting. I think a couple of you commented on how fun it is for the Sampson people to be talking to a bunch of people that we don't recognize, because we do spend a lot of time talking to ourselves. So how do we build on this? How do we keep this going? What can we do to bring the two species recovery efforts together in the future?
I'm thinking from the structures that we walked through today in terms of how we all work together in the salmon recovery world. And there's both the watershed scale and the regional scale. And now I'm thinking specifically of the Puget Sound, because that's what I'm most familiar with. But some of this is relevant to other parts as well of the state. At the watershed scale, I think that if there are folks that are networked and interested in work recovery that are getting more engaged in the salmon in their area and understand what the salmon river strategies are and can help support that work, I think that's a first step. That would be a really powerful coalition. And then at the regional scale, we have our Puget Sound Salmon Recovery Council. And I think it would be interesting to have some conversations about how to strengthen at that level a communication link between what we're talking about, Puget Sound Salmon Recovery,
what Orca folks are working on. I'd be happy to come talk to the Salmon Recovery Council anytime. You say that now.
Laura is our facilitator for the Salmon Recovery Council, so she has to know of that.
I think this is a good step. It's something that we've been working on a long time, just trying to make that link. I think I made Elizabeth come to an American Cetacean Society meeting and try to bridge that gap years ago. We had a meeting, it must be almost 10 years ago, to really get some of the salmon management and orca management folks together and talk about some of these issues. So it has been a progression, and I think this is a good step forward to bring these groups together. And I guess I would just say I'm open to suggestions as well. If there are ways we can plug that energy and passion that exists in the orca recovery world to help support the salmon recovery, ongoing efforts, you know, let me know if you have ideas and suggestions. Yeah, thanks. David?
I think I mentioned in my talk a little bit that I think it's going to be important that we set aside the issues that have been divisive between us over the years, and in particular harvest issues that sort of driven wedges between our communities. And while we've done that, while we've been fighting over harvest issues, Jeanette pointed out in her presentation, we're still losing wild deer for habitat every year. And we're losing estuary wetlands, and we're losing riparian areas, and we're losing salmon populations. And we can continue to fight over that last fish. I mean, we're really good at that, but at the end of the day, is it really going to accomplish what we want to do? So there are places where we ultimately agree. And I think what we need to do is work on those places that we agree. Salmon recovery is part of recovery. You cannot just separate. So if we're going to make a difference in this world, it's going to take more than just a handful of voices that are currently engaged in salmon recovery talking to ourselves. It should require you all talking to us, us talking together, you reaching out to your neighbors and partners who aren't connected yet and getting them connected so that we can make a difference. So we can make better decisions and voluntarily do things that make sense, but that when necessary, and we have to have the political muscle, we're going to argue for increasing PSAR funding from $70 million to $110 million. And those are incentive programs. Those are the kind of things that you all, you know, we're talking about. We're going to need a lot of voices in Olympia to make that happen, because there are lots of voices saying other things, and it's a competition. And we need to be down there together working on these things. So let's find those places where we can be together.
Elizabeth? I thought this was a really good discussion today. And like I said at the outset, it was really interesting. I expected to see more familiar faces than those that I didn't recognize, and in case it was the reverse. I'm wondering whether actually instituting this as a free literacy workshop or literacy conference would be a good thing to test that, whether there's that kind of interest. But I would say on the salmon recovery side, sitting in middle, that the place where we need help the most is on the habitat recovery, habitat protection side. We only have a limited authority through the administration of ESA in Section 7 in particular. When I started my slides, I showed you the layered structure we have at the local level here with state government and local government regulations. No one does not get involved in those unless we have a specific request to attend a hearing or something like that. But you all, those of you who are at Puget Sound or Washington State folks, do have an ability to engage there and to make us aware of what we need to do. So I think engaging on the habitat issues would be really helpful to the overall salmon recovery cause. We have a report released a couple of years ago called the Millie Judge Report, which was the status of the implementation of the salmon recovery, the Chinook salmon recovery plan in Puget Sound. And the report was pretty clear that we were moving forward as we had intended to as a region on harvest and hatchery issues because there was a predictable regulatory structure, like it or not. There was a very mechanical series of steps we go through to manage each of those ages, but there's no corollary on the habitat side. It's very fractured and more difficult to track and to assess problems on. So however you can engage on the habitat issue, I would encourage you to do so. If you'd like to talk with any of us from the federal side afterward about whether there's opportunity to talk with you in particular, on the habitat issues, one of the things that we cannot get our own head around, and that if each of us can think about and maybe make little incremental differences on, is stormwater management. It's a toxic soup every time we have a rainfall event in the river. There are little things each of us can do, how we choose to have our driveways, how we choose to dispose of things, simple things that we might do that cumulatively will make a difference in addition to all the political things that Dan was saying about talking to our decision makers. The final phase, just please engage in the habitat issue and take it in the workshop. Folks will be a lot better.
Thoughts, Jeff?
I think echoing what David and Elizabeth just said, those of us who've been working in salmon recovery for a long time recognize that it really is very simple, that it's the habitat stupid. And if we get that far right, we win on a lot of fronts. But with that said, and with all due respect to David, I think there are,
those of us who are in salmon management also talk about haulage management. And thinking about the interaction between how we manage hatcheries and how we manage harvest and habitat as the way humans interact with salmon is critically important. I think there is room for improvement in all of those. And I don't want to say that, I don't want to be in a finger-pointing game that this is somebody else's problem, it's all of our problem. We need to think about creative new ways to work with the habitat we have, improve the function of the habitat that we have or we would like to have, but also think about how we manage hatcheries. And I think some of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of timing of fish runs and how we might change our hatchery production and adjust our fisheries to have a more resilient system in the context of habitat restoration are critically important. With that said, on Davidson, who was in my talk, that I can recognize this, but we don't really have an orca or a salmon problem, ultimately. We have a human problem. The orcas and the salmon were doing really well until the current crop of humans came here and changed everything around and changed the relationships between those systems. And they went through bad times and they went through good times, but they bounced back and they were all here when we came to visit. And our visit hasn't been a very pleasant stay for either species. So I think what we really have is a human management problem. And the most interesting part of the discussion up here that I've heard was the comments about how to engage young people, what to do about shoreline management, about whether or not we're voting. So I would suggest that if we do this again in 2 years, although this will be in BC, and I don't know how well we can take this again. Having a panel of social scientists, they're not social scientists, having a panel of people up here, maybe they're marketing specialists, maybe they're people who work on electoral campaign, people who can guide us through a discussion about how to actually set goals that move human behavior from where it is right now to a different place that is more attentive to the needs of things like orcas and salmon that we don't care about.
All right. You want to wrap us up? It's 5 minutes.
Yeah, just really briefly, just building on what some folks were mentioning. One of the big things that I mentioned before that a bunch of local jurisdictions just went through is updating their shoreline rules through a state required process. That's phasing out. Most jurisdictions have completed or are very close to completing the process, but what's coming up next through the Growth Management Act is the updating of their comprehensive plans, which are also have a lot of elements in it that can be seen. So for those of you that have been interested in this part of the conversation, that would be willing to be engaged in your local processes, that would be a huge opportunity to have people engaged in talking to their local officials and planners about the importance of thinking about salmon and habitat and orcas as they're updating their comprehensive plans.
Okay. So on that note, I want to first of all thank you all for coming and thank our panelists and speakers for and thank the core team of folks who are very dedicated in putting this together on a shoestring budget. Thank you all for a great job there, Susanna and others. And to note that we did come away with some next steps about hoping to connect the orca and salmon worlds, helping everyone get involved, perhaps having a biannual or annual workshop attached to the Salish Sea and maybe even more frequently than that. And we should note that we did invite a lot of people from Canada, but there are a lot of reasons why they're not here, ranging from travel restrictions to family emergencies. So hopefully we can do a better job connecting with family members. And then talking more about social science and how to change the problem. Lots of exciting stuff. So thank you all for sticking with us and enjoy the Salish Sea Conference this week.